From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the TV season is a year-round endeavor now, but networks still stock up on September premieres. Then I meet up with director Justin Chan in a karaoke club in Koreatown. It's a neighborhood he knows well and the setting of his new film, Ms. Purple.
It was a different place in the 80s and 90s, and now it's become such a gentrified neighborhood that sometimes I don't even recognize it. And I wanted to tell a story about the people who are still here.
And we'll introduce you to an all-female mariachi group that's putting a twist on tradition. All that coming up on The Frame. September doesn't just mark the end of summer, it's also the start of a whole new season of television. Network, cable, and streaming platforms all have new shows premiering in the coming weeks, so we checked in with Hollywood Reporter TV critic Daniel Feinberg, and he said one of his top recommendations still has a pretty small fan base.
The thing that I'm currently kind of banging the drum for is Lodge 49 on AMC. It's halfway through its second season. It is a quirky, strange, funny, mystical little show that really is not going to survive if people don't watch it. It's not going to be a show for everyone, but I want people to watch it. I felt the same way, though, about Succession when it started, when I was worried that maybe people wouldn't find that show. And as you look in the second season, at least my Twitter feed has found that show completely.
There's some shows that I think you and I are fans of, like Baskets on FX, that are coming to an end. When you think about long-running successful shows on other networks, The Good Place on NBC, Mr. Robot on USA, American Horror Story also on FX, how much are the networks maybe still riding a successful show, and how much are they trying to wring out every possible rating point? In other words, do some of these shows feel like they've run out of stories to tell?
I think that if you were to look at those shows you mentioned in particular, they probably haven't really gotten to the running on fumes stage. If you look at something like Mr. Robot, I think the USA, when that show premiered, thought it was going to usher in a brand new USA age where they were part of the premium TV conversation. They thought it might have been a hit, Emmys, all that stuff. And instead, it ended up having one really big Emmy year where at least it was in those conversations and then kind of vanishing. And if nothing else, they decided they wanted to let Sam Esmail finish the show on his own terms. I think that there is a certain amount of latitude when it comes to the generosity of allowing these shows to build audiences. But then you have something like The OA on Netflix, where heaven knows you couldn't find a more passionate audience for a strange and problematic and weird show. But Netflix just decided we can't be bothered, or we don't want to, or it's too expensive to keep the show going to whatever the creators wanted to go to. So I don't know that there's any one rule or one answer.
Of course, the people who are most passionate about The OA have actually been at Netflix picketing in front of the streaming company's headquarters in Hollywood, hoping that they will somehow bring it back. Probably not going to happen. You have watched hundreds of hours of new content coming in for this fall and through the winter. And I'm curious, when you step back and say to yourself, where does it all leave me? What are your overall impressions of what the networks are trying to do or trying to do too much of?
One thing I would say is that last season I had very little hope as I looked over the fall offerings. I think this is a season marked by initial mediocrity that in a perfect world could expand into something good. So something like Stumptown or Emergence on ABC, I can imagine a world in which those two shows could become something decent. I could imagine a world in which the sort of pseudo-exorcist dark comedy of Evil on CBS from The Kings, the creators of The Good Wife and The Good Fight, where that could evolve into something good. But if I'm going to be forced to write reviews based only on the premieres, only on the pilots, and that's unfortunately the business that the networks still function under, my reviews this fall, you're going to see at least 10 different reviews that are, okay, this is not so great. I can see how if these five things improve, it could become solid. And while on one hand that's hopeful, it's probably not what they're looking for if they're actually looking for any strong recommendations or positive reviews.
Later this year, Disney Plus is going to start its streaming service. How quickly will Disney Plus be judged in terms of its original content? Because I know they've got a Star Wars live action series that is probably going to launch in a couple of months.
I think Disney Plus has done such a good job of setting itself up. I think that they have managed to not only make it clear why potential subscribers would want the service for new programming, but also why the library that they have is so unprecedented. And so, say, for example, The Mandalorian, the Star Wars series, fails, that it's unbearable, that it's horrible, and everyone thinks it's dismal. I don't think that's going to happen. I have seen only the 2-minute trailer. I have no clue. But even if that happens, Disney Plus still goes, okay, yeah, but we've got 17 Marvel shows coming up. We have everything from the Disney animated library except for Song of the South. We have 600 plus episodes of The Simpsons. One thing failed, whatever. In contrast, if Apple and its TV service, which we still don't know when it's going to premiere, we still don't know what's up first, etc., if one or two of those shows fail, then that's pretty much all that Apple has, or all that Apple has told us that they have. The interesting thing is going to be if Apple releases a show or two and they were wildly expensive, star-studded shows and they make no ripple, where does that put Apple? I mean, for heaven's sakes, does the company have anything else they make? Little joke there, not worried about Apple, but I am worried about how it will reflect on Apple as a streaming service.
No, I've talked to a couple people who have different shows at Apple, and they have described a completely dysfunctional creative process. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. Daniel, always a great joy to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we take a short break, this news, the Associated Press has published another story about Plácido Domingo, with more women coming forward with allegations of being sexually harassed by the opera star. The story quotes LA opera employees who say management there has known about his behavior for years. A spokeswoman for Domingo disputes the allegations. LA Opera has hired a law firm to investigate Domingo. Coming up on The Frame, filmmaker Justin Chan's new film, Miss Purple, is set in L.A.'s Koreatown. I took a trip to L.A.'s Koreatown recently with Frame News clerk Andrea Gutierrez.
Is this it, or is this the back of some abandoned building?
I don't think people generally see it during the day.
We met up with director Justin Chan at Soup Soak. It's a karaoke club where much of his new movie called Miss Purple was filmed. It's about a young woman who puts her life as a pianist on hold to pay for her ailing father's care by working as a hostess at karaoke clubs. We arrived at Soup Soak before it opened. I chatted with a filmmaker in the parking lot before its owner arrived.
So when you came and started scouting locations, how much did you tell them about what your movie was about?
We're pretty honest. We're very honest. But the first day we showed up with the crew, we had said we were like a kind of a student film.
And you showed up with like all your trucks?
Yeah. And he was like, no, there's no way you guys are a student film. We're going to have to talk about the rate and all this stuff. I was like, no. But then we worked it out with him.
And has the owner seen the movie yet?
I don't know.
Well, let's take a look inside. Oh, we got the lights on, the mirror ball.
Lights. So this is a room that final scene was shot in, the intense scene.
Yo, Casey, pour him a f***ing drink. Pour him a f***ing drink.
What's up, beautiful?
How you doing? Pour him a f***ing drink.
How you doing? Have a seat.
And then pour us a drink.
When you were thinking about making this movie, did you start with a character who was caring for her ailing father? Was her job working in karaoke bars essential? What was the nature of how those two things came together?
The first and foremost thing is I wanted to tell a story about a brother and sister, specifically that dynamic, because I have a younger sister and I haven't really seen it explored much in film other than You Can Count on Me, The Savages, Skeleton Twins. And I knew I wanted to set it in Koreatown because, you know, growing up and coming here so often, it was a different place in the 80s and 90s. And now it's become such a gentrified neighborhood that it sometimes I don't even recognize it. And I wanted to tell a story about the people who are still here. Mm-hmm. And they grew up here. And it almost sometimes feel like it's a time machine and that has moved forward, but they've been left behind. And that always fascinates me, and sort of the idea of unfulfilled dreams and people who come to this country and don't quite fulfill what they set out to do.
Do you ever wonder where the money comes from?
I know where it comes from.
Does it bother you?
No. Casey, it doesn't bother me. Casey, whatever you had to do to keep Dad alive, I don't judge you for it, okay?
I wanted her to have a job that was compromising because I thought that that really showcased how stuck in her own world and how stuck in the position she was in and something that she needed to break free of. In Korean, it's called Doumi, which literally means helper. And basically, they come and it's sort of you're paying for companionship. But the reality of it is, in present day, it's a very big mix of girls, and a lot of these girls are either trying to pay off, you know, credit card debt or student loans. And during our research, we even found like girls who are trying to make business connections. So some people utilize it for their own sort of business building in a weird way.
We're talking with Justin Chan, the writer and director of Miss Purple. There are a couple of relationships that you're examining. One is a brother-sister relationship, and the other is a father and mother relationship. And the mother of these children makes a choice that is radically different from the daughter.
Yes.
The mom says, see ya. Mm-hmm. And the daughter, I think, feels an obligation mm-hmm. to stick around yeah. and not take something that might be more attractive.
Yeah, and I think a theme that I do consistently explore in my films is collateral baggage, like the baggage you bring from the old country and the customs, and what are the things that you should keep intact and what are the things that you should shed once you come to a new country and assimilate. And there is a dichotomy that is very obvious where the mother lived her own life and you know, deserted the family, but then the daughter's stuck, and she has this filial sort of duty that is sort of cultural for a lot of Asians, you know, or a lot of people that are not American.
Please don't leave.
I'm sorry, Mika. I took another job at a hospice.
But please, you can't leave. You have to give me at least enough time to find someone else.
You told me months ago you were looking for someone else.
Juanita, you can't do this to me.
It's too late. I have to go.
The relationship she has are all with different men. She doesn't really get to have a relationship with her mother. Like, there's no real scene that she interacts with her mother. So we don't know quite what that relationship was like, but she has, you know, the Chicano possible love interest, and she has the you know, very nasty, you know, karaoke relationship she has with that man. She has her brother and the dad. And I think each one of those relationships represents something different. And as a woman, she dealt with everybody in such a different way, and I that was very important to me because I wanted to explore all those aspects of how these men sort of influence or how she deals with them or the obligation she feels for them.
If she didn't have to figure out how to care for her father, would she be playing piano? What was the dream that she gave up, and why did she have to give it up?
Yeah, you know, at the midpoint in the film, she does talk about, you know, her brother kind of says, hey, you know, look what I found. And he finds like a tiny electric keyboard in the closet. He asks her,
listen, you used to love playing that thing. You went to school for fucking piano.
Yeah,
how do
I
you
know
not...
I went to school for piano.
Yeah, and you didn't finish. I mean, you liked it, right?
Yeah, I liked it.
So why did you finish school?
Dad?
I think that's pretty common. You know, I've heard a lot of people that I know, personal friends, who were really great at something that they loved and had to give it up to help run their parents' store or help their parents with their business. And it felt very true to me. But if the dad had not gotten sick, and the dad is such a dark reminder that the American dream doesn't always, it's not all roses. Sometimes it doesn't go in your favor, and the two kids are sort of casualties of that.
There are some very specific things about LA in this film. There's a line about how even the palm trees are not native, mm-hmm. and then there's a shot of the piano in Union Station where people mm-hmm. can actually play. How did you cast the city in this film?
Specifically in Koreatown, there's a constant theme of green. And green to me equated money. And also it was just perfect for us because I always wanted to name the film Miss Purple. The color purple is the color of mourning, like mourning someone's death in the Korean culture. Hence the color of her dress, which is also like baggage from the old country, and she has to shed that. But I remember one time a friend from New York, we'd hung out, and he's like, yeah, man, the only thing I notice or kind of feel about L.A. is all the damn palm trees. And I'm like, what? No, there's no palm. Like, what? That's a stereotype. There's no palm trees in L.A. And he's like, what? Like, they're everywhere. And then I remember coming back from a trip, that trip we were on, and I came back and I looked up, and there are palm trees everywhere. I had never, and but it's so symbolic to where you grew up. The thing I wanted to say is you don't take the time to look up. And the metaphor of the palm trees, they're not from here. They're all transplanted here like all of us are. But they're dying. I mean, palm trees aren't meant to be in this climate. And it was such a great metaphor for me for who belongs here. Are we meant to be here?
We're in this room at Soup Soak. And inside this room, there's a scene that involves violence. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that it's a violent scene, but it's that it is violence committed by men against women that seems ordinary and acceptable.
I knew I wanted to have a female protagonist, and I found myself trying to make everything fair. If something bad happens to her, something good has to happen to her. And I realized I was doing a disservice if I wasn't being honest. And what needed to happen, I felt, for Casey, the main character, is that she was so stuck in this mindset and going at it alone and feeling like taking the whole burden of the world. And for her, she, as a woman, she feels so alone. But there are so many people that would, you know, just are there to support her. She just scared to ask. And I feel like, especially in my community, the women, especially the older generation, they are really scared to ask for help. Hopefully with my generation, the generation younger, it's you don't have to be ashamed to ask, because there's plenty of people who are there for you.
Justin, great to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, John.
Thank you
guys
so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Miss Purple is in theaters starting September 6th. Coming up, an all-female mariachi group that's mixing traditional music with R&B. They play traditional instruments and can belt out classic Mexican songs, but the New York-based group Flor de Toloache is not your granddad's mariachi. As The Frame contributor Beto Arcos reports, the all-female group is creating a new music style, blending traditional mariachi sounds with R&B.
It's midday at the LATV studios in West LA, and mariachi Flor de Toloache is warming up for a performance on one of the cable channel shows. After the performance, I sat down with the leading members of Flor de Toloache for an interview. Violinist and singer Mireya Ramos grew up in Puerto Rico. Her mother is from the Dominican Republic. Her father was a mariachi musician from Michoacán, Mexico. Ramos says one day she felt a calling.
I had the desire to collaborate with other women. I was one of the only female musicians playing mariachi in New York City during that time. This is about 7 years before 2008. And I just wanted to do my own arrangements as well and my own compositions.
2008, Ramos called Cuban-American singer and guitarist Shay Fiol. They met through a mutual friend from the R&B scene, and together they decided to form the group Flor de Toloache. In the beginning, they played all the usual mariachi gigs, quinceañeras, weddings, birthdays, funerals, and they were also buskers, playing in Manhattan subway stations. Singer Shay Fiol says the subway gigs helped to audition potential new members.
We also knew who was committed by the ones that would come out to the subway with us, of the players. And then we got to try out a lot of new stuff. It was basically like rehearsal, like a paid rehearsal with an audience. But that wasn't technically a show.
There was one thing they had clear from the get-go. Their goal as a group was to do a fusion of mariachi and other music styles. Violinist Mireya Ramos.
It wouldn't be genuine to us to do traditional mariachi because none of the girls actually come from mariachi tradition other than me. And I wasn't raised in Mexico. My approach to the mariachi was from far away, from Puerto Rico. So even for me, it wasn't that genuine to do just traditional Mexican mariachi. So the goal was always to do new arrangements and to kind of experiment with the genre.
When they decided to record their first album, Fiol says they needed songs.
And we had some of our own songs written already from our own projects. And then we're like, well, let's bring these in and do them Flor de Toloache style. And so Let Down was one of the first ones. And it definitely had R&B vocals already. But what we needed to do was adapt it to using the guitarrón and the vihuela and the trumpets, you know, put all these different mariachi, like, technical styles into the song.
And to you I was the gold you saw at the bottom of, at the bottom of the street.
For their new album titled Indestructible, Flor de Toloache collaborated on a song titled Te Lo Dije with the pop singer Miguel, who happens to be Ramos's cousin.
It was an amazing experience to be in the studio with him. And also, it was so emotional because his grandmother and my grandmother used to sing together in Mexico, in Michoacán, Mexico. They used to have a duet called El Dueto Heredia, and Heredia is their last name. And they had just passed away not too long ago before the session. So it was a really emotional session. It felt like they were there with us and that they made this whole thing happen for us, you know, so it was really pretty.
For the song Quisiera, Shay Fiol says their producer, Rafa Sardina, offered to invite pop singer John Legend.
He's like, well, let me see, you know, I'll talk to him and we'll see if, you know, we can sing in Spanish, but we wrote in English first just in case. Mm-hmm. And he was into it. And so, you know, we're like, okay, we shot for the stars. Let's shoot for the stars and think of who would we want to sing on this album. John Legend, of course. Quisiera ser el asa de
tus ojos. Still, Cuban-American singer, guitarist Shay Fiol says there's a certain responsibility that comes with being part of a mariachi group, playing Mexican music.
Not being Mexican, there's a lot of pressure.
Right.
You got to show up and really know your stuff. And not only that, but, you know, respect the tradition and the culture because mm-hmm. people are looking at you because you're not.
You're
so
right.
They want to be like, and?
Yeah.
What are you doing? And why?
Flor de Toloache won a Latin Grammy for Best Mariachi Album in 2017 for their album called Las Caras Lindas. Despite all the recognition, violinist Mireya Ramos says they're still criticized for not following the traditional mariachi aesthetic.
They still come to us and say, oh, that doesn't look good. You should wear a skirt, you know. Oh, those shoes don't look good. Even our hair, it should be back and that curly and out, you know. It's like, it's wrong. It's like there's these mariachi laws that we shouldn't cross. And I don't know who put them there.
And why they can't.
Yeah.
I asked the members of Flor de Toloache to tell me the story behind the band's name. They said Flor de Toloache is a desert flower. It's also called Devil's Trumpet, and its seed is protected by spikes. It's a flower you don't want to mess with. It's fair to say the band lives up to its name. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. Toloache, bella flor, reina de toda ilusión.
And that's all for today. Remember, you can keep up with us through our weekly email, which goes out every Thursday. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.